One of the chapters of the Bible that has most encouraged and inspired Christians has got to be chapter 21 of the book of Revelation. You heard a reading from that earlier. And in it, the Apostle John describes a great city called the New Jerusalem, which at the end of time descends out of heaven down to earth. And we're going to begin by reading it again. Revelation chapter 21, verses 1 to 3. And I'll be reading a certain amount of this chapter just to set the scene for this sermon. Verse 1. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. Now, several years ago, in fact exactly 7 years ago, of course it is the book of Revelation, but I did a sermonette on this subject, and I thought, as we're now several years closer to the time when this for us will be a reality, it will be time to revisit this particular subject. So if you've got a really good memory, you may remember one or two things I said back then, but I mean there's a lot of new material here, of course. Now, the New Jerusalem has been a subject of various imaginative depictions by artists over the centuries. I'm sure we've seen a number of them, but I'm equally sure that none of them come anything close to the reality of what God has in store for us. But the book of Revelation does give us an impression of what it will be like, and a description of a few of the details. So let's read a bit more of Revelation 21 and see what we can find. We drop down now to verse 9. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven plagues came and said to me, Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And he carried me away in the spirit to a mountain, great and high, and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. Some people are not actually convinced that the new Jerusalem will actually land on earth at all. It says it's coming down from heaven, but you sometimes see it depicted as kind of floating on the clouds somewhere between heaven and earth. But I think it's clear enough from the Bible it actually will come down and be grounded on earth. And most Bible commentators actually believe this. Verse 11, this is now, we're dropping down to verse 11 of Revelation 21. It shone with the glory of God, and its brilliance was like that of a very precious jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal. So one of the first things you can say about the New Jerusalem is that it will shine. It will be a city of light. And it won't be just a city that shines. We'll come back to this in a moment. Verse 12. It had a great high wall with 12 gates, with 12 angels at the gates. On the gates were written the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. There were 3 gates on the east, 3 on the north, 3 on the south, and 3 on the west. The wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. The angel who talked with me had a measuring rod of gold to measure the city, its gates, and its walls. The city was laid out like a square, as long as it was wide. And he measured the city with the rod and found it to be 12,000 stadia in length. We'll come back to that. 12,000 stadia in length, as wide and as high as it is long. He measured its wall, and it was 144 cubits thick. Okay, a cubit is about 18 inches, so about this is 70 yards wide, I guess. By man's measure, which the angel was using, the wall was made of jasper, and the city of pure gold, as pure as glass. Now, verse 19 goes on to say that the foundation of the city walls were decorated with every kind of precious stone, and verse 20 lists the actual stones. Right, we won't go back. In verse 21, the 12 gates were 12 poles. Each gate, you okay? Yes, each gate made of a single pole. The great street of the city was of pure gold, like transparent glass. All right, well, we've established that New Jerusalem will not only be a city of gold, it will be a city of light. One of the main characteristics of the city, it will be extremely large. I'll tell you what 12,000 stadia mean shortly. But when I read about the characteristics of the city, I was rather reminded of a very famous modern Israeli song. It would have been nice to be able to play it here. But it's the unofficial Israeli national anthem, written only about in the 1960s. It's called Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. I first came across it when we were approaching Tel Aviv Airport, when I visited Israel. And they played it over the aircraft tannoy, which tells you how important this song is. But the translation of Yerushalayim Shel Zahav is Jerusalem, City of Gold, or City of Light. And I thought, well, that's interesting, that, because given it was written by a modern Israeli Jew, it's interesting how that title exactly reflects the description of the New Jerusalem in Revelation 21. I don't know what there is in the Old Testament which gives them this idea, but it's exactly their aspiration that they want, they would love Jerusalem to be just that, the city of gold, the city of light. Okay, let's read on to verse 22. I did not see a temple in the city, because the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. So the people who inhabit New Jerusalem won't need a temple through which to approach God, because God himself will be living there. The temples of the past would have served their purpose. Okay, we're now down to verse 23. The city does not need the sun or the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives it light, and the Lamb is its lamp. The nations will walk by its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. Another thing I think that indicates the city really is grounded on earth. Verse 25, the NIV says, on no day will its gates ever be shut, for there will be no night there. That's slightly awkward, but what that means is anciently walled cities, which of course would have walls, and they would shut their gates at night for security reasons, and reopen them again at daybreak. But given that in the New Jerusalem there won't be any night, there'll be no reason to shut the gates. And the presence of God will give the inhabitants of the New Jerusalem all the assurance of security they could possibly need. Verse 26 and 27. The glory and honour of the nations will be brought into it. Nothing impure will ever enter it. We're not talking about fleshly human beings here. Nor will anyone who does what is shameful or deceitful, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. But we are written, brethren, right now. Well, having set the scene, let's ask a few questions about the city itself. I've got seven subheadings. As I did the sermon 7 years ago, I happen to have seven subheadings. So there we go. It's all about seven, the Book of Revelation. Okay, my first subheading is, well, what will it look like? Now, strange to say, in spite of the dimensions given in the Book of Revelation, the shape of the city is a bit controversial among some Bible commentators. It's funny how we can sometimes put a great focus on fairly unimportant issues, although I've just raised the point, I guess I'm doing it myself. But the city is described as laid out as a square, its length, its breadth, and its height exactly the same. Now, that, of course, will be true either of a cube, okay, or actually a pyramid. That's also true. Now, some people believe it will be shaped like a cube. And I recall that the Holy of Holies, of course, in the biblical temple and tabernacle, were shaped like a cube. Other people think it will be shaped like a pyramid, rather like one of the pyramids of Egypt. And I've seen artistic depictions of the New Jerusalem as a cube. I've seen it as a pyramid. I think the point to realise, the New Jerusalem is very, very large, but it's also very, very high. It will reach out, well out in what is today outer space, well above the level that many of our artificial satellites orbit the Earth today. It's a significant proportion of the size of the Earth. Personally, to me, a large pyramid on a round earth looks a bit better aesthetically than a large cube. And it would, of course, allow God to place himself rather logically at the apex, at the highest point of the city. But that's just speculation on my part. I might be wrong, and it might be a cube, as most artists seem to depict it. We'll just have to wait and see to be sure. Now here's something intriguing. My second point is, how large will be the new Jerusalem? And this came to mind because I remember many, many years ago now, hearing a sermonette in church in which the speaker had quoted from a religious tract, which was entitled, "The Size of Heaven, Your Assurance That There Will Be Room Enough." Now, up until then, of course, I'd never worried personally there might not be enough room in heaven for all the people in it, but obviously some people had. So, in passing, before I tell you the details, there's a possible reason for some Christian evangelists not to be too enthusiastic or successful in their evangelistic campaigns. Because, maybe, if they were too successful and there were too many conversions, they started to get a bit crowded in heaven. Imagine a bit like the London Underground in the rush hour. You know, standing room only, move along inside please, mind the doors. So the religious tract aimed to reassure its readers about the vast size of the New Jerusalem. Now, from the dimensions given, 12,000 stadia is a Greek measurement, but it's equivalent to our modern, about 1,400 to 1,500 miles. It will be absolutely gigantic, and if it was superimposed on a map of present-day Europe, it would cover virtually the whole of Western Europe and a lot of Central Europe as well. Now, to compare it with a city we're all familiar with, the area that the New Jerusalem would occupy at ground level would be equivalent to 15,000 Londons. 15,000, it's 15,000 times larger than London, okay? And that's just its footprint, because being a city, commentators assume, like many modern cities, will also have different floors or levels or stories. And when you take that into account, it makes an even larger amount of room for the inhabitants. Now, the people who can be bothered to do these kind of calculations have estimated on the basis that each individual story or floor will be about 12 foot. Where's 12 foot? Probably up to those lights up there, maybe, just above the emergency exit sign. That looks like about 12 foot to me. Fairly generous allowance. And if it was 12 feet, the New Jerusalem would have 600,000 floors or stories, right? And if it was a Jerusalem was a cube, which makes the calculation a lot easier, 600,000 stories, multiply an area of 15,000 Londons. If you do the calculation, you end up in concluding the effective floor area of the New Jerusalem would be equivalent to 9 billion Londons. 9 billion Londons. The New Jerusalem will be a big place. I mean, to give you an example, the present population of the world is about 7 billion, I think. That's the last figure I've heard. If you put the entire population of the world into the New Jerusalem, every single individual person would have a personal space equivalent to London all to themselves. So, I don't think there's any possibility of the New Jerusalem being a bit crowded. If you were talking humanly, I would have thought loneliness might have been a bit of a challenge. You've got an awful lot of space. So, it's quite clear. But, of course, that put me in mind of Christ's words to his disciples in John chapter 14, verse 2. John chapter 14, verse 2, where he said, and I'm reading the New King James now, "In my Father's house there are many mansions. If it was not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you, a place in the New Jerusalem for us. And if I go and prepare, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, you may be also." Where will he be? In the New Jerusalem. So that's where we will be. Where the New King James says many mansions, other translations say many rooms or dwelling places. The original Greek word is a bit unspecific what the dwelling places are. But it does strike me here that the key word is actually many. You know, this city, like modern city, will have distinct dwelling places for its inhabitants, and there will be a vast number of them. So we ourselves, of course, are individually one of several million inhabitants of Greater London. New Jerusalem will clearly have billions. How many? I don't know. The present population of the world is 7 billion. How many people have ever lived? How many people will be redeemed? I don't know. But the point is, there's a vast amount of space. And we need to think about this, because this is our destiny. This is our future. Something perhaps we don't always think about in the midst of all our troubles that Barbara was talking about. Isn't it easy to focus on our present day troubles and not on our eternal destiny? It's worth thinking about our eternal destiny from time to time. Okay, third subheading. How will the inhabitants enter into the New Jerusalem? Why will they be there? Well, the answer is through faith. It's always been like that for people who worship God. Now, the other reading that was given was Hebrews chapter 11, wasn't it? Verses 8 to 10. Hebrews 11, verses 8 to 10. Let's read it again. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he didn't know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land, like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. Okay? What is the city with foundations? Well, it's the New Jerusalem. And who's the architect? God. We can be sure it will be a perfect place. Now, God called upon Abraham to leave his own native city of Ur in Mesopotamia. But actually, he knew very little specifics about what God actually had in store for him. Although over time God progressively did reveal to him additional things, in the final analysis, God was asking Abraham the same question he asked us. Do you really trust and believe me? That's the question. It's not the specifics of where you're going. Do you believe I know what I'm doing? Do you place your faith in me? And Abraham's obedience, a willingness to leave behind the comforts and culture he'd known in Ur, was the visible manifestation of that trust in God. And it wasn't much different for us. I can't point out to you that Ur was the epitome of culture at the time. What did Abraham have to do? Did he go to another city just as nice as Ur? No, he didn't. He lived in a tent for 100 years, right? The immediate consequence of him leaving Ur was to make things worse, physically. That's the consequence, right? But you place your trust in God's promise, and you don't expect God to fulfil his promise straight away. So, although God may not call us to physically leave our dwelling places in order to worship him, although he may do, and personally I have to tell you, there were a couple of occasions in my own life where I actually had to relocate. I believed I had to relocate in order to worship God. I think that was the case. So we may have to leave behind some things in our present day culture, some of our associates, but if we do, we will find out in the end, and in the end of course means in eternity, that God will have something much better in store for us. Okay, point four. They, I mean the inhabitants of the New Jerusalem, they will be like Christ. When we are in God's presence in the New Jerusalem, we will have been changed into Jesus' likeness. We won't be like we are now. And being like him, the lives we experience will also be like his. We can turn to 1 John chapter 3. Yes. Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us, that we should be called children of God. Therefore the world does not know us, because it did not know him. Beloved, now are we children of God, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be. But we know that when he is revealed, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. I think, do we turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 2 verse 9? A bit more information. However, as it is written, no eye has seen, no ear has heard, no mind has conceived what God has prepared for those who love him. But God has revealed it to us by his Spirit. The Spirit searches all things, even the deep things of God. So, what God has revealed through his Spirit is an inkling, a foretaste of what we shall be like. But the fullness, to know for the fullness, to experience the fullness, we'll have to actually be there. So God has given us enough information to give us the vision of what is to come. Now remember, I said earlier that the city will shine. But of course, as its inhabitants, now redeemed, so will we. A bit disconcerting for this, isn't it? But in Daniel chapter 12, verse 3, Daniel is told, those who are wise, this is the distant future, those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens. Those who lead many to righteousness, like the stars, forever and ever. Obviously, Jesus will still be who he is, and we will still be who we are. We'll not be Christ's equals, and of course we are still very physical beings right now. And as you get a bit older and visit the doctor a bit more often, like I do, you soon realise that you are still a physical being. So it's hard for us to grasp exactly what our future life is going to be like. But we certainly should expect the same quality of life as Jesus Christ in the New Jerusalem. Okay, point five I've written. They will live together as a community. They will live together as a community. The key word is community. When one reads about the New Jerusalem, there's a natural tendency to put a lot of emphasis on the city itself, which I, of course, have done myself. You know, the gold, the shine, the fact that it shines, the glass size, etc., etc. But the New Jerusalem will not be just about the city, it will be about its inhabitants primarily. It's going to be being part of it. We'll live as a community there, that's the point I'm getting. And you can't help but notice some similarity between the community of the New Jerusalem and that of the church. You know, we as Christians, we normally live in our own homes and we attend church once a week. But most of us here, I think, have experienced retreats or festivals of various kinds where we kind of move away from our regular homes and live together in a different location for a few weeks. And that, in a way, is a kind of an analogue of what the New Jerusalem will be like. We'll be gathered together and live together as redeemed saints. Even as I say this, I'm conscious of how imperfect our Christian communities can often be. I mean, look, let's get real. Would you like to live for eternity together with each and every member of the church you've ever known? Would it sound like paradise to you? Or maybe a bit more like eternal torment? But, you know, we are imperfect now. We're talking about people made perfect in the future. And as it says in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 22, no need to turn there, we will come to the spirits of just men and women made perfect. I do recall, don't take this too seriously, a limerick on this theme. Somebody else has already had a similar kind of experience from another church or other in the past. And he wrote a little limerick, which a bit silly, but went, "To dwell above with saints in love, well, that will be a glory. But to dwell below with some I know, well, that's another story." But seriously, we better get used to the idea and put a bit more focus on being together, fellowshipping with each other, because that is our destiny. Okay, point six, and I've written about the inhabitants. They will have a ministry. They will have a ministry. Because the next question is, of course, what would the inhabitants of the New Jerusalem actually do for eternity? You sometimes get the impression that some people envisage life in the New Jerusalem as some kind of celestial retirement home, you know, where there's nothing much to do all day except plucking your heart while waiting for the next meal. I mean, the thought of eternity of a life like that, I'm sorry, it wouldn't do it for me. But, you know, there are a number of statements in the New Testament that in eternity, the saints will be given positions for authority and rulership. This is very much about having a job to do for eternity. Revelation 3 verse 21.
Yeah.
To him that overcomes, I will grant to sit with me on my throne, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. And when you're seated on a throne, you're exercising rulership. And you're exercising rulership over somebody else, whoever it is. But of course, God's concept of rulership is quite different to the world's concept of rulership. And we can see that in Matthew chapter 20, verse 25. But Jesus called them to himself. You know, the disciples, I think, at that point had been arguing about who was the greatest. But Jesus called it to himself and said, look, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. And you see, you read the newspaper today, and you can see exactly that. Great dictators lording it over the people they rule over. But it shall not be so among you. Whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. Now, here are a few scriptures which are going to give us an inkling of who it is we will be serving. Hasten through them very quickly. No need to turn to them, but I'm sure they'll all be very familiar anyway. In Isaiah chapter 9 verse 7, famously when we read refers to the birth of Jesus Christ, it says, of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. Can we go to the beginning of Isaiah 9? Yes, a big print this. keep going. Here you go. Well, I'll just scroll down a bit. I'm thinking of verse 6. I'm thinking, unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulder. And it says, but the key word in verse 7 is, of the increase of his government, there will be no end. It will be continually expanding, and I think we'll be able to see later on why this is. Also in Isaiah 65 verse 17, it refers to the fact that in the future the earth and the heavens will be made new. And in fact, so new that the earth and the heavens that now exist will be completely forgotten. When God creates new things, he often creates new life. And that's confirmed in Romans chapter 8 verse 21, that's Romans chapter 8 verse 21, because we read that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and obtain the glorious liberty of the children of God. I mean, I'm interested in astronomy, and in one big change that has occurred in the last 20 years is that technology has developed to the extent it's been possible to prove something that was only ever speculated about before, that there are thousands and thousands of planets out in the universe orbiting other stars. And although you often read this very optimistic description of a search for an Earth-like planet, every time you read something, you soon realise the reality is that these planets are in a state of decay. They're too hot, they're too big, they're in the wrong place, they orbit multiple stars. Everything tells you, in spite of their frantic efforts to find another place like Earth, that the universe is in a state of decay, it's in a state of chaos. There's no life there. So for the increase of God's government to have no end in a new heavens where there will be new life, many commentators believe that God's government will be seated in the New Jerusalem and will extend out into the new universe. And for that government to take effect, of necessity, God will have to create new people, new human beings, that he will rule over and bring into a relationship with God. Now, that's speculative. I did say that God doesn't tell us everything he's going to do now. We mustn't believe that. You can see throughout the Bible itself, God's revelation is progressive. It's a little bit here, and a little bit more, and a little bit more, and a little bit more. And it'll be the same for us. We have an inkling. We know something
We look ahead through a glass darkly, like the patriarchs did themselves. They didn't even see Christ necessarily very clearly, but they knew God had something better in store. Now here's number seven, and this is perhaps something I found a bit mind-blowing to think about it. The title of my section 7 is They, that's the inhabitants of the New Jerusalem, are promised the universe as an inheritance. Have you ever had the experience that you study something in the Bible and somehow or other it suddenly causes you to look at a familiar scripture in a completely different way? I had that experience recently when I was preparing this sermon. And here's the familiar scripture in question. It's Romans chapter 4, verse 13 and verse 16. It's Romans chapter 4, verse 13 and 16. Yeah. And we read, for the promise, I assume this is the King James, I'm not sure which translation, it says, for the promise that he should be the heir of the world was not to Abraham or his seed through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. That's that word again, faith. Verse 16, therefore it is of faith that it might be by grace, to the end that the promise might be sure to all the seed, not just Abraham, all the seed, not to that only which is of the law, but also that which is of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. Now when we read this verse, verse 13, it seems fairly obvious what it's saying. Abraham was originally promised that he would inherit the land of promise. And this promise was later extended to encompass the whole earth. And we as his spiritual descendants enter into that promise. And so the promise to Abraham that he would inherit the whole earth is also promised to us. But of course, if that's true, it's also true the other way around, isn't it? In the same way that what is promised to Abraham is also promised to us, of necessity, it also follows that what is promised to us is also promised to Abraham, because we share the same inheritance. Now, those of you who've heard messages I've given in the past will know that when looking at biblical passages, particularly when they might be a bit difficult to understand, I do like looking at the original Greek or Hebrew words, because sometimes it can help us to better understand the passage in question. And Romans chapter 4 is no exception, because the Greek word in verse 13, that's Romans chapter 4 verse 13, that describes what Abraham will inherit, is quite interesting, because it is the word cosmos. Now, this is a word that's recently been imported into the English language, and this is used to describe the entire universe. I'm sure you've heard there are people like Stephen Hawking, remember him, who studied the universe, and they're described as cosmologists. Now in Greek, the word cosmos is spelt the same way as it is in English, except it begins with the letter K rather than the letter C. Otherwise it's the same. And in Greek it literally means the created order. The created order. I suppose it's what kind of many Christians would call the creation. But the emphasis in Greek is on an orderly creation, you know, a place for everything and everything in its place. Now what did the cosmos mean to the ancient Greeks when Paul was writing? And that depended on context of how the word was used. Sometimes it just meant the world we were all familiar with, planet Earth. And that is the way, incidentally, the Bible translators tend to want to translate it as. Now here's an example, 2 Peter chapter 3, here's an example. We read, whereby the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. So what is that talking about? That's a reference to Noah's flood, isn't it? And quite clearly it was only this planet that was overflowed with water. But Peter uses the word, the translated word, as cosmos. The cosmos that then existed perished being flooded with water. So it's quite clear that to Peter, he's using the word cosmos to mean the earthly creation, just this physical planet. But you can see from elsewhere in the New Testament that sometimes the word cosmos is used in a much, much broader way. In Acts chapter 17, remember when Paul went to Athens, he tried to help the Greeks understand the nature of the true God, not the idols they were used to worshipping. And we read Acts 17 verse 24. Can you look at the RS? Have you got the RSV there? Can you do the RSV for me? This is what's in my notes. I'm just comfortable if you do that. Okay, right. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in shrines made by man. Now, there's a problem with this translation that I need to point out to you. In English, we tend to think that the word world and the word earth are the same, don't we? They mean the same thing. The world is the earth, and the earth is the world. But that is not the way Paul is using his words in Greek. The word earth, yeah, is a translation of the Greek word gi, right? And this is a word that's got into English, like words like geography. We all studied geography at school, didn't we? Or if you want to dig a bit deeper, literally, you can study geology. It's very much all about studying the earth, our physical planet. But when you look at the word world, it's using that word cosmos again. So I could quite legitimately and more clearly read that verse as the God who made the cosmos and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth. So it's quite clear here that Paul is using the word cosmos to include both heaven and earth. The totality of creation, I mean everything, the universe, exactly the same way the modern scientific people use the word. And there is one Bible translation that actually recognises that and translates the beginning of the verse as the God who made the universe and everything in it. So when we go back, if we go back to Romans chapter 4, where we read about the promise to Abraham and to us as his spiritual descendants, was Abraham promised only to inherit the earth? You know, the gi that we all learned about at school, as in geography or geology. Well, the promise included that, but that's not all he was promised. Because when we read the original Greek, we find that Abraham was promised the cosmos, the totality of creation, the universe. I have to say, this has made me look at this scripture in an entirely new way, in a way I've never done before. I suppose what happened was that, because, as with the other Old Testament states, Abraham spent his entire life in the Middle East, didn't he? All I could think of was, oh yes, his promise of the promised land, they got extended to the entire earth, isn't that wonderful? But to be frank, if we as his spiritual descendants are going to inherit the new heavens, the new universe, of necessity, as the father of the faithful, so will Abraham. So as I wind up this verse, I think we can see that our future is going to be more than just inhabiting the new Jerusalem and having a comfortable life. The new Jerusalem is going to function much more like the capital city of a new universe. Living as we do in a capital city like London, we should have no difficulty getting our minds around this one. Now, there's much more you could say about this subject, but even though there are many things we don't know about the New Jerusalem, God has given us enough to whet our appetites. The city itself will be wonderful, but even more importantly, will be the descendant of a new cosmos, or new universe, in which God will give new opportunities to his redeemed people to serve his eternal purposes.